Welcome to the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy, and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. Today, it is a great pleasure to be joined by Sarah Ellis, co-founder of the pioneering Amazing If Company and co-author of two Sunday Times best-selling books. Sarah and her business partner, Helen Tupper, developed the innovative and much talked about Squiggly Careers framework. Together, they now host the hugely popular Squiggly Careers podcast. They set up their company more than 10 years ago to, in their own words, make careers better for everyone. And since then, Amazing If and Squiggly Careers have redefined how millions of people think about careers and personal growth. The company has also developed partnerships with some of the world's best-known brands, including Microsoft, Sky, KPMG, British Airways, Unilever, and the World Food Programme. Last year, Sarah won a place on the inaugural Women in Leadership Power List, which showcases 20 of the most significant businesswomen in Britain today. And it would be remiss of me not to mention one of Sarah's other great achievements. She's also a graduate of the Nottingham Business School. So Sarah Ellis, welcome back, albeit virtually, for this episode of the NBS Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
No problem. So for the handful of people who haven't yet read one of your books or listened to one of your podcasts and episodes, tell us a bit about Squiggly Careers.
Well, Squiggly Careers really came from when Helen and I, so my business partner and I, both of us left Nottingham Business School together as friends. We were like, right, we know what our job to do is. We're really ambitious. We're really driven. We need to climb the career ladder. So it's about kind of what's the next step, following in other people's footsteps, doing what people have done before. So we were like, well, that's what our career is going to look like. That ladder is the framework. But then really quite quickly, I think we started to recognise that that wasn't reflecting either of our experiences or actually even the aspirations we had for ourselves in terms of where we might go, what we wanted to do. And it was the same. It wasn't kind of just us. It was the same for the teams that we were leading and the organisations that we were in. But there didn't really seem to be another way of describing careers. So I remember just drawing this sort of flowy, squiggly line on a bit of paper and said to Helen, I was like, careers are just so much more squiggly. We develop in different directions. We're unlearning, relearning all of the time. There's more opportunities, but there's also more obstacles. It's all a bit less predictable than it used to be. There's new skills that we don't know we need, new job titles that I can never wrap my head around kind of anymore. And that's what we just said. We just started to talk to groups about this idea of squiggly careers. And what we could see quickly was that it connected. You know, so everybody sort of nodded along to like, oh, actually, you've just given me a way of naming and thinking through my career, which just feels much more realistic, more relevant. And then actually people move on from that quite quickly to then, okay, great, well, how can you help me? If my career is going to be squiggly, which pretty much now everybody's is, no one has a straight line to success. And I can promise you I've spoken to some amazing people and nobody really kind of climbs the ladder in a predictable way. What are the skills we need to help us, given now we are going to squiggle our way to success?
The one thing I get, and I think a lot of people get this, when I go on the website, I watch your videos, I listen to the podcasts, is two things. You and Helen are prolific, absolutely prolific. There's so much volume. And you're also incredibly generous. Are you conscious of that? Or is that just something that's happened naturally?
Well, I think so. Our number one value in our company is to be useful. And actually, it's a sort of very straightforward and simple word that drives a lot of what we do. So how can we be useful? Are we as useful as we could be? And actually, I think when you start to really then combine that with our mission around making careers better for everyone, if you believe in the everyone part of that statement, you need to make sure that you really are trying to be useful for wherever people are, whatever stage of their career they are at. Now, some of the time, we work with really big companies across the world who can invest money in working with us, and we can design career development programs and reach lots of people that way. But sometimes you might be in a company that doesn't have those resources. So from day one, we've always been really clear. We wanted to do really useful career development that was either free or very low cost as part of what we've done. And we've always done that since we started. And I think it means that we can reach more people, we can help more people. And I think when we then reflect on our most memorable moments, but also the things that we feel most proud of, it is always when people share those individual stories of, I really remember one lady told us, she went into an interview and she was describing her career. And then she got out our book, which has a big squiggle on the front of it. And she was like, well, I've had one of these, I've had a squiggly career. And then she wrote and told us that story. And I think, well, that's brilliant. She doesn't have to have lots of money. She just has really got to have a kind of interest in learning. And so, yeah, I think we are an unusual company in that we are business to consumer and business to business at the same time. But I think we have felt that that's, we kind of helps us in lots of ways. And rather than feeling like we had to make a choice and kind of let the other one go, which I'm sure lots of people would have told us to do. And, you know, sure, maybe you could have made more money if you don't do the free stuff. But then I don't know whether you'd feel as good about the impact that you have. And that's really important to us.
That's interesting. Do you see yourself in a privileged position as being able to do that? You know, you make the brass from one side and yet you're able to give back with the other.
Not really, because I think we've always done it. So, and actually we did the individual work first. So we started our podcast where we both got other full-time jobs. We weren't running our company. So we were doing it in our own time. It was costing us money. It wasn't being funded from anywhere else. And actually, yeah, generally podcasts, books, all of those kind of things, you don't really make any money from those things. You just reach lots of people. Do I think now, you know, the more organizations we work with, that does definitely fuel that. It gives us that ability to keep doing it. But that has always been true, not only kind of in the last, say, 5 years, where we've now got very big, recognizable brands that lots of people would know, where we run their big careers week or we run big careers programs. So we've stayed true to our roots, I think, and that stood us in good stead.
So is it too trite to say, is this a vocation rather than a job or a career?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I do feel like I have found probably the thing, or one, at least one of the things, because I also think we have multiple possibilities, where I can probably be the best at that thing. And so I've done lots of things in my squiggly careers. I mainly worked in very big organisations for over 20 years. I worked for Boots in Nottingham, and I loved that. And I got to work in lots of different teams. I worked for LucasAid. I worked for Barclays in financial services. I worked for Sainsbury's in retail for quite a lot of years. And I worked in marketing and innovation. So not in career development. And I loved lots of those jobs. And I was good at some of them, better at some than others. And I had some brilliant leaders who I will always be very grateful for, because I think I learned a lot from them. But I do feel now the sense of connection and care I feel for Amazing If, our company, and for Squiggly Careers is another level compared to even somewhere like Sainsbury's, where I loved working at Sainsbury's. I loved the people. I liked the brand and kind of what they stood for. And so it wasn't like I kind of hated the corporate world. I actually really enjoyed it. It took both Helen and I quite a long time to leave our corporate jobs because we both enjoyed them so much.
Okay, so you've thrown up so many things in that landslide. So let's just take one of them. I think you talked there about Barclays, GSK, Sainsbury's. But so you had a previous leadership career. So I believe that you set up Amazing Enough as a side hustle, which you did in parallel with your leadership career previously. So what persuaded you or even enabled you to take the plunge?
So it was hard. That was a hard decision because, I was really enjoying the jobs that I'd got, and I'd worked really hard to find my way into those roles. I think it was ultimately a one conversation, one moment. So there was a brilliant lady called Lisa Thomas, who I knew a little bit already. She actually knew Helen better than she knew me. But we were at the same breakfast together, you know, like a kind of learning breakfast. And I saw her and she said to me in quite a kind of direct, blunt way, almost without any kind of precursor, so why are you just not doing Amazing If full time? And I hadn't got a good answer. And I realized that the kind of the answer I was telling myself was like, oh, you know, I need to save up more money, or there's practical considerations. And I realized that actually the reason I wasn't was completely mindset. It was the kind of fear of letting go of the big brands that I worked for, the shiny job title that I'd got, the relationships that I built up. And I think I remember thinking, oh, but people are not going to be interested in me or what I do in the kind of same way. And it felt like a lot to let go. But I think I've been kidding myself that there were these other reasons, and they were actually excuses. And so sometimes I think you do need someone to call you on it. I would call it a really nice nudge that Lisa gave me that day. And I walked out of that building and thought, I actually just need to make a choice. I either need to do it and try it for a year. And then, do you know what, after that year, someone would give me a job back in marketing if it didn't work, or choose to not try it and be okay with that. So like, what do you want to do, Sarah? And I do remember thinking, I'm going to be working for a long time. I think I will always regret it if I don't give it a go. But I was still really scared.
So it was someone you sat next to at a business breakfast. It's as random or as individual as that. Yes, serendipity. Right, I've got you. Right, okay. So going back again to your original answer, another thing you threw in there was the importance of mentors. Lots of the leaders I interview talk to me about that kind of thing. So who were your mentors? And you don't have to name them, but what did you get from them?
I think with mentors, sometimes it can feel like quite a formal phrase. And I would encourage people to think of it much more informally. I would ask yourself the question first, what do I want to learn? And then think, who can help me? Because I think, you know, it can be something like, well, I should have a mentor. But also the barriers to getting a mentor can feel really hard. Like, how does that happen? Maybe I'm not that senior in my career. I feel a bit nervous about asking somebody. Whereas I think if you can be really specific about the support that you're looking for, you're much more likely to get a yes in return. And I think that's one of the things that I did well. Because I got good clarity on, you know, what I wanted to do, where I wanted to go, I'd kind of thought about different career possibilities, I could then approach people for that support. And I think I had two different types of mentors, some that were internal in the organizations that I was working in, who helped me to increase my impact in the job that I was doing today. And then they opened up opportunities for my future where I was. And then some external mentors who I could borrow brilliance from, who helped me to stay really curious, who gave me a different view of the world and a different perspective. And I think one of the things that we see really commonly with the work that we do is you get quite internal focused and stuck in your silo. So I would really encourage people to, any opportunities you get to spend time with people who are different from you and kind of outside of your ordinary, is just so, it's so useful to kind of broaden our thinking. So I think I did both of those, and that's one of the things that I did well. And I was never afraid to ask. So I think sometimes we can be a bit apologetic about asking. And I think I was always okay with going, well, you are incredible. I would love to learn from you. But just always know the answer to that question. The one thing I got wrong, which I would never want any of your listeners to get wrong, is I was once meeting, still my friend today, a lady called Scylla. Dame Scylla Snowball, to give her a full title. And so I was meeting Scylla, and I remember, you know, people are really busy. So we grabbed a coffee, we sat down, and she just said to me, right, Sarah, I'm here to support you. How can I help? Great question. And I had been a bit lazy and just thought, well, Scylla's so brilliant, I just want her to tell me how to be as brilliant as she is. Like, impart all your wisdom on me, Scylla. And she was very kind, and she let me kind of find my way through to a kind of answer, and we kind of got there. But in that moment, I thought, you should always know the answer to that question. If people are giving you their time, they want to be helpful. So be really clear about how they can help. You might not know all of the ways, but have at least one way.
Okay, so you've ended that answer as you began the other answer, I think, talking about clarity. And clarity really is something that does come across in your work. You know, you do these 6-7 minute sprint podcasts, and I marvel at how you and Helen keep to the point. There's a little bit of humour, there's obviously a lot of warmth, but how do you stick to the point? How do you, and that, you know, extrapolating that to what you've just talked about, I think you, before you go into these conversations, you need a little bit of knowledge. You need to have thought it through. And the clarity is often the bit that a lot of people struggle with, in my experience, the scattergun thing. Where do you get your clarity from?
I think we ask ourselves and each other the question, what matters most? And probably have a bit of empathy with people working, because we've been and still are in roles that are really demanding and in those organisations where you've got kind of lots of meetings. And so I would rather people know one thing and know it well and can use it than five and you're kind of a bit all over the place. I think probably what really helps with the clarity, like we're writing our next book at the moment, and I was just thinking about kind of clarity as you were asking that question. I think it really helps that there are two of us. So if I was kind of giving our draft of a book a kind of clarity score out of 10, I think if one of us wrote it, you'd probably get to a 7 out of 10. Because, you know, you're smart and you work hard at it and you want to be clear. But by doing it together, you actually get to like to a 9. Because you spot inconsistencies, you spot where somebody isn't as clear as they could be. We can give each other that fast feedback. We've known each other for a long time. And we both have a kind of drive and desire to communicate in a very kind of clear, simple and straightforward way. We talk about being simple, but without being simplistic. So we have done the research, we have done the reading, but that doesn't mean that you've not got to include all of that. You then sort of ask your question, that question, like what matters most. There's a great lady called Liz Wiseman who Liz wrote a book called High Impact Players. And she said the people in organizations who have the most impact are always asking the question, what's most important now? You know, they can sort of cut, they can find the signal amongst the noise. And so I think we both kind of bring that sensibility and we're not afraid to be simple.
Okay. So part of the answer might be to go and get yourself a good partner.
Well, I think a big part of my answer to life and all of work is that.
Is that right? So, which begs the obvious question, you were together studying at Trent at Nottingham Business School. Did you ever envisage your own squiggly careers would come together following the same path?
No, well, we weren't even friends initially. So anticipating running a company together would have been a bit of a stretch. So Helen and I are really different in lots of ways. So we've got very different interests, really different hobbies. She's really extrovert. I'm much more introverted. I think a lot of our skills and strengths are pretty different. What we have in common are some of our values. Our individual personal values. So Helen's number one value is achievement and my number one value is achievement. Now, what that means to us is actually slightly different. So I like long-term goals to go after, like big ambitious goals, and Helen likes lots of wins along the way. But if you combine those two things, you get to a driven pair of people coming together who want to win along the way and then go after big goals. You're like, oh, that's quite a good combination for running a company. And so, no, I don't think we ever envisaged it. We did become friends only really towards the end of our time in Nottingham. And we were both working at Boots. And there was kind of a moment actually where Helen basically sought me out because I'd done particularly well in one kind of assignment. I was very good at we had to do reflective portfolios and I was very good at them, which probably tells you a bit about why I do what I do today. And Helen was very smart at going, right, well, if Sarah's got that right, what is it she's doing well? And so she came and found me and she was like, tell me what it is you do. And like, why are you getting such a good score on this thing? So that was very smart. And then we found we did get on. And we then had sort of some parallels in some of the career choices that we made. We both kind of went into very big organizations, worked in sort of FMCG. We were both in marketing. We had some similar learning experiences. We never lived in the same place. Ever. So Helen was up in Nottingham for a while. I was down in Leicestershire. I moved to London. Then Helen moved sort of outside of London. She had some global roles. So we probably only ever see each other once or twice a year. But every time we did, we always really got on. And actually, the moment Amazing If started, the side project kind of came to life, though no one used the word side project at that point, was when we were both London based. So actually the kind of the proximity and that ability to meet up after work, to have a coffee, to talk through ideas. Neither of us have got kids at the time either. I think really important to say we'd got loads of control and loads of time. And so actually it was kind of in that moment that was kind of the catalyst to start creating together.
And right at the beginning of that answer, you talked about that TED Talk, the 2021 TED Talk. I mean, I hope I don't overstate it when I call it the seminal, the one I kept on coming back to when I was doing the research, because everything really does flow from that. Does it help, I guess, if you're starting a business, if you're being a leader, if you have a, you talk about a basic set of values, I get that, but also a plan, a written down, a stated plan, and see if everything will flow from that. Because it strikes me that most things do flow from what you said there.
One of the very practical tools that I really remember us using, and we couldn't answer all the questions in the tool, but I think we did find it useful, was we used Lean Canvas. So Lean Canvas is sort of it's really simple, actually, to talk about simple again, seven box model. And it just asks you these seven questions, essentially. And I remember we went through that, and that really helped us to spot the gaps that we've got. It helped us to recognise that we were a B2C and a B2B company at the same time. Like, how do we feel about that? I don't think we ever had a master plan. I think we were very driven by what we enjoyed. And I think that is a good way to work. So, you know, we did a podcast because we fancied it, basically. We were like, oh, that's a good chance to chat to each other once a week. And this is before anyone had a podcast and before anyone listened to podcasts particularly. So that was really an excuse to catch up and talk about something that we cared about, which was career development. The workshops that we used to run in London, which were very early versions of what is now Amazing If, we just invited our network and our friends, and we were like, oh, if your teams want any like career development, we're testing this workshop on strengths tonight, if anyone wants to come along. And so we always got loads of energy from it. You know, I always came away feeling more energetic than I had sort of beforehand. And I think that's a really good signal and a sign that you're doing work that you care about, that you're choosing to do. Like on a Monday night, we would leave very busy jobs, meet up, plan a workshop, deliver a workshop sort of 7 till 9 p.m. and then go home and then get up the next morning, usually really early, back to the old day job. But I remember always looking forward to doing those and never thinking, oh, I wish I wasn't doing that tonight. It always kind of really, yeah, just gave me that kind of motivation.
In fact, it was the other way around. You were thinking, oh, I need to do a bit more of that. Is that right?
Yeah.
So therefore, you know, you want to do a good thing. Okay. So now we're going to take a quick break from our chat to mention the MBA programs at Nottingham Business School. As we've learned from many of our guests, effective business leadership is about confidence, adaptability, and thinking strategically. These are the key ingredients to delivering innovation and impact in crowded competitive markets. So if you are ready to transform your career, visit ntu.ac.uk/MBA to explore the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. We're one of only 1% of business schools worldwide who hold the prestigious Triple Crown accreditation. That's ntu.ac.uk/MBA to find out more. Now back to the show. So podcasts, videos, books, you talk to a lot of very, very experienced leaders. What are the recurring themes? What just keeps coming up?
I think one of the recurring themes is that people talk to us about because of what we do is how to support people with their progression with some of the changes that are happening in organisations. So most organisations are getting flatter. So when I started, there was so much hierarchy and organisational charts and millions of boxes on those organisational charts. Nobody is adding more hierarchy or structure into their company. It doesn't matter whether they are a tech startup, a massive global company, it doesn't matter. Everybody is getting kind of more project-based, kind of flatter, much more skills-based.
Is that an acceptance of your squiggly career?
I hope so. I think partly it is. Sometimes I think it's an organisational need because now people are kind of clustering around jobs to deliver and get done or projects that need to happen. And organisations can't just, they used to be able to just promote people kind of slightly, not randomly, but like, oh, you've worked here for 2 years, get promoted. Worked here for 2 years, you get promoted. That just doesn't happen anymore. But organisations still want to support people to grow and learn, because if you don't feel like you're learning and growing, after pay, it's the second most likely reason that people leave. So if I'm not paid enough, fine, I'm going to leave. But if I feel like I'm sort of stalling or getting stuck, I'm also going to leave. And so the thing that we often hear from organisations is, how do we create opportunities for people to progress, to feel like they're learning and growing, but that can't always default to promotion. And I think actually in our experience, individuals are really up for that when organisations take it seriously. So we call it squiggle and stay. So how can you support people to squiggle and stay, to not feel like just where they are today is kind of where they have to stay, to not feel like promotion is the only way that they can kind of get new experiences or even kind of earn more money. And so probably that's the one of the biggest challenges that we hear, is like almost like that redefining of what a good career looks like when you're in a company.
And very briefly, within that, what's your answer?
Well, what we've done with organisations over the past few years, which has worked really well, is run, and this is kind of organisational level, but affects individuals, is we've run loads of experiments. So you can talk about this, or you can do something about it. And I think you've got to learn by doing. And so those experiments are things like, one of my favourite ones is Squiggly Career Safaris, which is where you, in an organisation, you give people, let's say 10 days to go on a Squiggly Career Safari to another team or another department. Maybe you do that all at once, maybe you do a series of one days. But essentially you are looking before you leap. You're trying before you apply, so that people can get a sense of where they might transfer their talents to, what that team feels like, because there's a lot of unknowns. And it's quite a brave thing. I did it in Sainsbury's. I moved from marketing to be head of corporate responsibility, and I'd never worked in CR before, ever. And so that takes a lot of confidence. And it's a brave move to make. And so something like those career safaris makes it easier for people to feel like they could go and just try out being in another team. Maybe they like it, maybe they don't, but either way, they've definitely learnt. So that's a really good experiment. Even people just sharing their squiggly career stories internally, particularly senior leaders, is really useful. I think because we look up to these leaders and we assume everything's worked out for them, they all had this master plan. It's never true. What they usually have got is a sense of what matters to them, what they're motivated by, but they've also been good at saying yes to opportunities, at doing something that scared them, that they didn't know how to do. And so actually people hearing those things from their leaders, I think is really useful. You know, the kind of the role modelling matters. We kind of know that. So it's those kind of experiments that I think individuals benefit from. Everybody always wants to have a go. We never struggle to get people to put their hands up to volunteer. And then organisations just need to kind of be, I guess, brave enough to try to do something a little bit different.
You clearly, clearly, clearly love your leadership. Is it the leadership that you love, or is it the topics and the people that you're dealing with?
What do I love? The thing I love the most probably is ideas. So it's another one of my values. I love creating from scratch. I like newness. I'm really kind of attracted to kind of new things. It's probably why you described as prolific, which I think can be a pro and a con. But both Helen and I like creating. So I think the thing that probably is the kind of the red thread through the whole of my career is creating something from nothing, doing something new, kind of trying things out. I really like experimenting. And it's less about, I don't mind if that's for an organisation as a whole or for kind of one individual. And what is most, I suppose, satisfying is when those ideas that you've had are then helpful for other people. So there's no point having ideas in a vacuum. It's actually seeing people talk about that they've used your ideas, they've used your work, and their career is better because of it, or other people's careers are better because of the work that you've done. So I think that's the kind of two dots that connect for me that kind of keep me going.
And that feeds into something else. As you become more successful, as more people use your work, as your company attracts more business, are you conscious that you are becoming a role model for that next generation of leaders, that next generation of entrepreneurs, that next generation of business people? And does that affect what you do and how you do it?
Yeah, I think I do. I take the accountability and responsibility of being a role model really seriously in a few kind of different ways. I think it's really important that everything that we talk about in the learning that we do, for ourselves in our organisation, and we do, and we try it all, and I talk about it in workshops, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and that's fine too. But it's really important that we do it. So things like when we're talking about high performing teams, we talk about things like mistake moments, getting people to share their mistake moments. We do that in our company. Every mistake you make in Amazing If, you share with everybody in the company on Teams. It's never a problem, and it works brilliantly.
I'm going to jump in here. I have to ask, so what's your biggest mistake?
My biggest mistake moment? Well, I've got loads. Most mistake moments are smaller. Actually, I know what my biggest mistake moment was. But the reason actually we should share them, back to that point, is actually if you share them, you're more likely to learn from them. Whereas if we don't share them, we're more likely to repeat them. So there's actually a really good impetus for doing this. My biggest mistake moment actually was when So I went into a board meeting when I was at a different, not here, when I was at a big company, a big PLC company, and I got to do a presentation at this board meeting, and I decided that what we had said we were going to do wasn't the right thing. We needed to do something different. And I'd had to take a really deep breath, and I was really nervous about doing it. And I'd spoken to my leader about what I was going to do. And she was like, right, okay, yeah, I'm on board. You know, I've done a bit of that kind of pre-work that you have to do with very senior people. And then I went in and did it and got support from everyone there. So I was like, oh, great, I've done a really good job. But there was one person who was actually really important, who was on the board, who I hadn't talked to before. And I definitely should have done. And it was a massive miss. But I think I was so, you know, I was really worried. I got a lot going on. And, you know, she spoke to me afterwards and was like, you know, I'm really disappointed. I was like, oh, my God, this is going to end my career. Because you spiral really quickly. I'm really disappointed you didn't speak to me before, Sarah. And, when someone says it and you're like, yeah, why didn't I? But, you know, when you're just like, but you didn't. So you've got to kind of accept it, take accountability. And I think sometimes it is okay to just say sorry. And I think I did just go with, do you know what, you are right, I'm really sorry. I remember being nervous seeing her for the next day. I was like almost being like, oh God, does she now think I'm useless because I've sort of made this mistake? And it, do you know what's funny is you definitely have to remind yourself, you probably take up 0.1% capacity in their head, and in that moment they tell you should have done something different. And they move on. But the problem is, you have to move on too. And I remember talking about senior leaders, Carolyn McCall. So Carolyn is now the chief executive for ITV. And she, when I met her, she was the chief exec for EasyJet. And it was like a mentoring lunch that she was doing, and I was in that room. She said that when she makes a mistake, she gives herself 24 hours exactly to dwell on it. She's like, you've got to let yourself like dwell on it, beat yourself up a bit, do the spiraling. So if you make it like midday today, you go, I'm going to give myself till midday tomorrow, to kind of luxuriate almost in the kind of like feeling down. Then she said to make herself move on, she writes down three things that she learned. And then that is like the tipping point where she's like, well, that's it now. The mistake has been made. I cannot change that, but I can control whether I learn from it. She writes down what she's learned and then she moves on. And I just really remember it as somebody who I can over reflect. I can definitely get stuck in my own head. For mistake moments, I found that really, really useful. So yeah, on role modeling, we do it as a company. The other thing I would say on role modeling now that I try to talk about whenever I can is when people talk about like setting up their own companies and being an entrepreneur, just the reality of that. And our reality, because I think sometimes people are not super transparent about how it works, how it's funded, what they've had to kind of sacrifice, maybe the support that they've got. So, you know, for Helen and we will always talk really openly about, you know, we have no external investment. So, you know, our company is kind of, we built it from the ground up. We also talk very openly about the support that both of us have. So, you know, you talk about, well, how are you able to do all of what you do? Some of that is a really practical thing around the support in our personal lives that we both have. Money and pay. People don't talk about money enough. We have paid ourselves from day one. Not quite our corporate salaries. We do now. But from day one, it wasn't quite our corporate salaries. But we certainly paid ourselves like enough that it wasn't stressful. And we were really clear that we weren't going to leave our jobs until that was true. And so we, you know, people talk about, I'm not going to pay myself for a year. And I just don't get it. I don't understand how that can ever be a thing. And that's never been Helen and I's reality. Like, we've always, like, you know, you've got really expensive childcare costs, because between us now, we have got a few kids. And, you know, you have got mortgages to pay and, you know, all of those kind of things. And I think that is slightly different role modelling. But I always try to be as open and honest as I can about how we work and how what we have around us, so that people just don't think, oh, this all just like magically happens, because it definitely doesn't.
Right. So you started that by being ever so candid about mistakes. So I feel duty bound to ask you the converse. What are you most proud of?
I'm probably most proud of the partnership that Helen and I have, because I think it is not easy to run a company where we went full time 10 weeks before COVID. And at that time,
I remember your coffee story. Sitting, standing there, watching your business run away from you. Sorry.
I did watch our business run away from us. So, like, our revenue went to zero really quickly because we did loads of speaking in person. So, you know, that all just kind of disappeared, and we had to kind of pivot very quickly. So, we have seen our company through COVID, through a few health challenges, through my dad dying, you know, big life stuff, as both having, like, I've got a little boy, Max, Helen's got a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old, all of that sort of stuff. And we're not always the same. And, you know, we do have different points of view, and you obviously have friction and difficulty and all that stuff. But I do think we have sort of always found a way. And I think that gives me a lot of reassurance and a lot of pride, because I think I'm not sure what else could be thrown at us. And there will be other things, I'm sure. There will be other things. But I sort of go, well, whatever that thing is, we will kind of find our way. And so I think, though, there are outcomes that I'm proud of, like the TED talk I'm really proud of, especially because of how we had to practice that, standing miles apart from each other in the park in the rain because of COVID. I mean, we recorded it in Abbey Road Studios, which was super glamorous, but we had to practice it nowhere near each other. We'd got a phone on the floor, rain was hammering down, and little grannies were walking past us, walking their dogs for their one outside walk that they were allowed that day, saying to us, oh, hello dears, like, what are you doing? And we're like, we're trying to practice a TED talk. And so, you know, when you just, like, it feels very, we often do talk about this idea of memorable moments. We have had a lot of memorable moments through Amazing If, like being on a TV ad, doing a TED talk in the rain, and then going to Abbey Road Studios, sometimes places we've traveled to do programs and stuff. And I think those things will always, they always make me smile.
Yes, I'd advise anybody to go and see that TikTok. Nine and a half minutes. It's great. It's great. And now you've added some colour. I'm always going to remember. I'm thinking about the old lady in the park. We're about to set up a fantastic company. Move on, dear. Right. So, as you know, as I've mentioned, this is a pod for the Nottingham Business School. So, finally, what single piece of advice, picked up during your own leadership journeys, might you have for the leaders, would-be leaders who study here?
Never live the same year twice. You can do the same roles, you can be in the same places, but just always think about how you can kind of learn and grow. I see more and more when people are kind of navigating their lives and their squiggly careers, where people feel like they are moving forward in their own way, whatever success means to them and kind of whatever ambition looks like for them, that can look and feel so dramatically different for everybody. I think it's just really motivating for all of us. I think we are hardwired to want to grow. That's the way our brains work. But that initiative, that create, don't wait mindset, I think has to start with us. So don't wait for other people to tell you what to do or kind of where to learn or what to learn. Figure out what you're interested in, curious about, intrigued by, and stay as curious as you possibly can.
Create, don't wait. That is a fitting last line. Sarah Ellis, thanks very, very much for joining us here on the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with Sarah Ellis, why not listen to previous episodes with the Chair of the Football Association, Debbie Hewitt, MBE, the CEO of Capital One UK, Lucy Marie Hagues, MBE, Paralympic gold medalist Charlotte Henshaw, MBE, or the CEO of Nottingham Building Society, Sue Hayes. This episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast was produced by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.